The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here on Thursday, July the 24th. Today, Britain's nuclear cleanup industry is in chaos, according to a government audit.
The government is essentially being forced to bail out nuclear by raiding greener alternatives.
Also today, we'll go inside the idyllic summer camp of the Kremlin's youth organisation. Vladimir Putin pants anyone?
Would you like to say that he thinks that the current Estonian president's politics are deeply hurtful to the Russian nation and to the memory of the Russian soldiers?
And we'll look beyond Hadrian's Wall into the life of the Roman Emperor, who's the subject of a new blockbuster show at the British Museum.
We didn't set out here to demolish long-established myths or anything, but to give the full picture. And as it turns out, the full picture is very different from the public perception in many ways.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with the news headlines and a look at the papers.
The US House of Representatives has passed a huge housing rescue bill. It paves the way for measures aimed at shoring up the country's worst property market since the Great Depression. The White House dropped a threat to veto it, which then spurred investors to snap up shares in struggling mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those firms are now expected to receive an emergency government lifeline. The bill now moves to the US Senate, where a vote could take place as soon as later this week. Oxfam's warning rising food prices are pushing East Africa to disaster. More than 14 million people in the region require urgent aid because of drought and spiralling cereal and fuel costs. Earlier this week, the UN said it needed £200 million to avert a humanitarian disaster. Agencies say the crisis is worse than the last regional emergency in 2006, when drought brought suffering to 11 million people. Britain is trying to water down tough new European legislation designed to boost the uptake of renewable energy. Documents obtained by The Guardian show the UK wants to block attempts to give sources such as wind farms priority access to the national grid. It's despite Gordon Brown's pledge last month to launch a green revolution based on clean technology. The European official who drafted the legislation is accusing Britain of obstruction, saying the UK wants to protect traditional energy suppliers and their coal, gas and nuclear power stations. Illegal music downloaders are heading for a red letter day. Six of the UK's leading internet service providers have signed a government-backed deal to target the worst offenders. Parents will soon learn of their children's piracy habits when warning letters arrive at the homes. It's estimated the practice could cost the music industry £1 billion in the next 5 years. The Zimbabwean government is struggling to find enough cash to pay its workers, including the military. It's been forced to cut back on printing money because sanctions have severed its supply of banknote paper from Europe. The regime also fears the presses could be shut down altogether if further political pressure causes the withdrawal of software licenses used to design and print notes. Paper money is already in short supply because of the huge demand created by hyperinflation. Many of this morning's papers lead with conclusion of the Canoe trial as John and Anne Darwin begin their six-year prison terms. We'll be covering this in more detail later in the programme. The headline in The Sun reads, "Shock and Awe," or as in paddle. The Mirror says Anne Darwin will return to Panama when she's freed from jail. It was a despicable deception, according to The Mail. And The Telegraph asks, are they now sitting on a £1 million fortune? The paper also claims an exclusive on the Tories as they plan to forge a new party with the Ulster Unionists. The Independent has a warning for holidaymakers heading to the Mediterranean, saying jellyfish are invading from Sardinia to southern Spain. While on the front page of The Express, a word rarely used in headlines, hooray, it exclaims, as holiday bookings soar by 63%. Most of the back pages continue to focus on the supposed fallout between Sir Alex Ferguson and Chelsea's new boss, Phil Scolari. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The Nuclear Decommissioning Authority is the government agency responsible for clearing up Britain's atomic waste. 2 weeks ago, MPs criticised the government for the uncertainty over the future cost of decommissioning UK nuclear sites. The authority admitted last week that the estimated cost of its future operations were £10 billion higher than they were 12 months ago. The government's commissioned an audit into the agency, and The Guardian's industrial correspondent, Terry McAllister, has the details.
What we've got hold of is basically an attempt by the business department to justify how this all went wrong. But in the middle of that justification are all sorts of details about how A didn't know what B was doing and this kind of thing. So that's the sort of context.
And, I mean, it's quite interesting. It's not just the financial affairs. I mean, you're saying the context, the chaos spread beyond the way that the NDA was managing its finances.
Clearly, there were a number of departments involved in the discussions over the budgets, and it's clear from these details that have now emerged from the Department of Business that there were meetings, very, very important, vital meetings that weren't minuted in any way. Both parties, there's one particular meeting where the Treasury and the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority officials both went away with completely different ideas about what had been agreed at that meeting, and they couldn't come to a conclusion about it because nobody had a minute of the meeting or any details of it.
Was this what the Department for Business meant when it said that there were inherent risks associated with the financial affairs of the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority?
I think that's a different issue, but it's the one that broke the budget, essentially. That's because two plants at Sellafield in Cumbria, which were meant to be reprocessing fuel for British and foreign companies, have not been working, and the income has not been coming in to the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority because those plants have been out of action. And that was why the budget was broken and has caused chaos inside the finances of the NDA. The issue is now whether that is a permanent thing because these plants are still not working properly. And so the income of the NDA is being questioned.
I mean, the government's having to fill this hole with taxpayers' money by raiding other budgets. And one of the areas that it's had to take money from is money that it wanted to spend on promoting low carbon and renewable technologies.
Yes, well, I mean, that is an extraordinary situation where the government is essentially being forced to bail out nuclear by raiding greener alternatives.
And the NDA has also been accused of being uncooperative with other bodies such as the Environment Agency.
Yes, there's been a lot of conflict between the Environment Agency and the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority about how much, how professional the NDA really is, whether they've got the skills inside the organisation to deal with the kind of problems they're having to deal with.
What are the government's options now from this rather messy situation that has become clear this week?
Well, I think it's absolutely clear that the taxpayer is going to have to fund even more of these budget shortfalls in future, and it raises a huge question about the efficiency of nuclear plants. The two facilities at Sellafield that have been causing the problems by not working properly, MOX plant and Thorpe, were both launched with very, very grand claims about what they would do and how much money they would bring in. Clearly, at a time when the government is considering new nuclear plants for electricity, it raises questions about whether there's overblown rhetoric being made about the future of those plants too.
Terry McAllister, and there's more on that story today at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also on The Guardian's website, follow today's Glasgow East by-election with our live blog of the campaign, and tonight, full coverage of the results and all the latest analysis at guardian.co.uk/politics. And there's full coverage this morning of the verdict in Max Mosley's High Court privacy case against the News of the World newspaper, mediaguardian.co.uk, for that. And the legendary guitarist Les Paul is interviewed by Ed Pilkington at guardian.co.uk/music. Today, John Darwin, who in 2002 faked his own death in a canoeing accident, and his wife Anne, who played the role of grieving widow, begin jail sentences of more than 6 years each. John Darwin admitted his role in the £250,000 insurance fraud, but Anne Darwin pleaded not guilty. She claimed her husband had forced her to support his story.
I got a telephone call from him at work on that afternoon to say that he was going to go out in the canoe and he wanted me to get home by 7 o'clock that evening to pick him up and to help him make his getaway.
That's from a recording of the police interviewing Anne Darwin. Well, she deceived even her own children. She was convicted yesterday at Teesside Crown Court, and reporting on the trial for The Guardian was Helen Carter, who says Anne Darwin's defence was unusual.
Yeah, it was a defence of marital coercion, that she was acting, her will was so overborne by her husband that she acted against her will. It was an unusual and quite ancient defence of marital coercion.
Why did the court find that defence unconvincing?
Because Anne Darwin had lied and lied throughout this case, you know, since John Darwin went missing in March 2002. For 5.5 years, until he reappeared at the police station in December last year in London, she played the role of a grieving widow, claiming, thousands of pounds in insurance policies. So she lied and lied, and when she was tracked down in Panama by journalists, she lied again. You know, she claimed that he only turned up in February 2003. But then there was this crucial photograph which emerged at an estate agent in Panama, date stamped July 2006, which showed that she was fully aware that her husband was alive and, you know, they were happily there posing in an estate agent in Panama. That was really what nailed it for her.
Anne Darwin received an even longer sentence than her husband. I mean, that reflected the role that she played in this deception.
Yeah, in a way, but it also reflected, you know, he was found guilty. He pleaded guilty, rather, on less charges. Some charges were ordered to lay on file in his case, so there were less charges. She denied 15 charges and was found guilty, so therefore, because she denied the charges, she got a slightly longer sentence.
One of the most dramatic moments in the trial, Helen, was when Mark and Anthony, the sons of John and Anne Darwin, gave evidence against their mother.
That's right. It's very unusual for two sons to have to give evidence for the prosecution against their parents, you know, a key part in this fraud. It was a very unusual case for people to have to give evidence against their parents, and it's almost unheard of, because normally they would side with them, I suppose, but they were key prosecution witnesses. But they had to show that they were innocent and that they didn't have any idea of the plans, and it kind of made the prosecution case stronger that she would even lie to her own sons and maintain the deception, not just from the police, the coroner and the authorities and the insurance companies, but also her own sons.
Why did John Darwin suddenly and dramatically walk into a London police station at the end of last year?
John Darwin probably heard that, you know, the net was drawing, and there's another theory that his visa in the name of John Jones in Panama was expiring, so he had to come back. There's also theories about, you know, they had difficulties in their marriage and maybe he wanted to embarrass her. I mean, only John Darwin will know, and Anne Darwin perhaps will know why he returned. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. They claim that they wanted to repay the money, but the judge rejected that assertion and said, you know, they were clearly not going to repay the money and totally rejected that suggestion. So no one will ever know until he writes a book. He's supposed to be writing a book in prison because he's had a hard time in prison, given that he's a former prison officer. And it's such a high-profile case. All joking aside, he's been self-harming. He's suffering from depression. He's quite a pitiful figure in the dock today. You know, a shadow of his former self. He was previously, you know, a man of kind of status, owning this portfolio of properties, driving a Range Rover with his personalised number plate. So, you know, he just looked rather tragic and pitiful today, really.
Helen, many thanks. I'm John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, the Emperor Hadrian at the British Museum and Sam Roddick, the owner of the erotic boutique Coco de Mer and daughter of Anita Roddick, talks about sex toys, human rights and her late mother.
Whereas somebody might recoil in horror at the notion of doing a certain sexual act, when you present it with a twist that encompasses beauty and great quality, then suddenly it becomes a consideration.
But first, on the shore of one of Russia's most picturesque lakes, hundreds of tents have been erected in a shady pine forest. There are portaloos, washing lines and cooking pots. Oh, and strung between two trees in a central clearing, Andy Warhol-style portraits of Vladimir Putin. Welcome to the annual summer camp of NASHI, the Kremlin's youth organisation. Luke Harding reports.
I'm with Dmitry Ivanov, who's a NASHI activist at the annual summer camp, about 7 hours' drive north of Moscow, situated in an idyllic lake beach with people doing dance music and canoeing, yachting. But Dmitry, you are dressed up, covered with American dollars, and you have an American flag on your hat and a pig. What does this mean?
Dmitry is dressed as an evil American and is looking after us, a pig which has been named in honor of the Estonian president, Ilves.
Dmitry, why do you not like the Estonian president?
Dmitry would like to say that he thinks that the current Estonian president's politics are deeply hurtful to the Russian nation and to the memory of the Russian soldiers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's to do with a row with Russia accusing Estonia of rewriting history of the Second World War and supporting, as Dmitry sees it, fascism. The Kremlin created NASHI in 2004 as a response to the Orange Revolutions in Ukraine and also in Georgia. Can you just tell us, Dmitry, why are you a member of NASHI? What made you join this organization which strongly supports the Kremlin and indeed is funded by it?
Says that he joined as a patriot, as a Russian patriot, and that he's not willing to give up his country to anyone at any time.
I'm with Antonina Shapovalova, who is a fashion designer for NASHI, who's done a whole series of amazing T-shirts with patriotic slogans. Antonina, just tell me, what sort of T-shirts have you done, and what kind of message are you trying to communicate through fashion?
The main message is that Russian is really modern, Russian is really on the peak of fashion, and we can make our history, our culture, show it in clothes, and to show people that it's really good, and that Russian people can be proud of the history
their
country.
You became very famous. Your design for bikini bottoms, which had the word Vova, Vladimir Putin's nickname, on them. Putin with you all the time. What was the idea behind having Putin pants?
When I designed it, when I think about it, about this design, I thought that it must be famous. It will be popular because Russian people has a good sense of humor. You know, it's patriotic and funny in one. In the same time.
I'm now looking at a rather extraordinary sight. There are about 20 Russian couples who are just getting married, wearing various national costumes from different parts of Russia. There are some Caucasian grooms looking rather fantastic in brown hats. They're now all going on stage. They're going to be married in a collective ceremony in a few minutes from now. And I think the idea is to try and do something about Russia's dismal birth rate, which currently sees far more people dying than being born. Male life expectancy in Russia is 58, female life expectancy is 70, and the population is shrinking, currently at 141 million. Quite a surreal and rather tacky and rather joyous scene. People are waving flags with teddy bears on them.
Итак, дорогие друзья, пары готовы!
I've now just left Nashiland and I'm walking past the camp on my way back to Moscow. I have to say it's an idyllic spot. There are all sorts of marvellous birds and terns flying over the lake. It's a lovely spot for a two-week holiday and a good moment as well, a perfect place for young people in Russia to bash the Kremlin's enemies.
Luke Harding reporting. Hadrian, who ruled the Roman Empire between 117 and 138 AD, is best known in Britain for the wall he built between England and Scotland. But today, a major new exhibition, Hadrian, Empire and Conflict, opens at the British Museum. It reveals Hadrian as a bloody tyrant, but also a widely travelled military leader, a patron of architecture and the arts, and a lover. A giant marble bust of Hadrian, discovered only last year in Turkey, is the very first object visitors see as they enter the exhibition. And it's where I met the exhibition's curator, Torsten Opper.
A year ago today, no one knew it even existed. Brand new find. We have a fantastic portrait head of Hadrian here, fragments of a right leg and a right foot in an elaborately carved sandal. Absolutely fresh, but not only big and impressive, also the best quality of carving you can get.
What would an image of Hadrian like this have been meant to convey to the subjects of the Roman Empire?
Just the power of the empire and of the emperor himself. He's an almost godlike status. The way this statue was made, with marble extremities and probably a wooden torso, is in fact a technique used mostly for cult statues. And the emperor gets the same. And he really, in the Eastern Empire, they treat him as a god. He was a great benefactor of the city, Sagalassos, in southwest Turkey, where this statue was found also. So they were really personally probably very grateful to him.
One of the themes of this exhibition is to deconstruct some of these myths about Hadrian that have developed and get closer to what he may have been really like.
The questions we ask of the past and the way we see Hadrian depends very much on our own experiences. We didn't set out here to demolish long-established myths or anything, but to give the full picture. And as it turns out, the full picture is very different from the public perception in many ways, or the way we like to see him for a long period. He was that peaceful intellectual philosopher ruler. Here in the exhibition we can see that there's much more to him, and not only nice things. He was a very hardened and at times extremely ruthless military man. In the showcases further down we have very touching material from Israel that has never left Israel before. There was a large Jewish rebellion late in Hadrian's reign. Took the Romans completely by surprise. Many thousands of Roman soldiers died, but ultimately the Jews were slaughtered in the hundreds of thousands. The objects in these cases are what some of these Jewish refugees took with them to their hideouts, in this case a particular cave in the Judean desert. They all perished.
Interestingly, one of the first things he did as emperor was pull the troops out of Iraq.
Quite, and I think whatever your individual political take on the current situation is, it makes it very immediate. And you realise that, in fact, you know, the Romans dealt with the same problems. In fact, you can. It's not only Mesopotamia. The conflict zones now were the conflict zones in Hadrian's day. The Balkans, the Caucasus, Mesopotamia, the Middle East, Israel, Palestine. It's, in fact, the end of the Jewish rebellion, the Roman victory, is the beginning of the Jewish diaspora.
We're looking now at the head of Antinous. Now, Antinous was Hadrian's lover who died in mysterious circumstances in the River Nile.
People have given all sorts of reasons that it was an accident or he was murdered or committed suicide. We don't know. I mean, I think this is the Paris Tunnel in 1997 all over again. Of course, you know, people are intrigued. The nature of their relationship wouldn't have been anything unusual for the Romans and wouldn't have given rise to any comment whatsoever. I mean, that simply wasn't an issue. We're looking here at a magnificent marble statue, a head. The eyes are now empty, the eye sockets, but they would have been inlaid in different material, lending a very lifelike gaze to this face, and a beautiful face it is.
Is there a particular object here that you're particularly proud that the British Museum's got the opportunity to exhibit?
One of the last things in the exhibition we see is a papyrus fragment. It doesn't look like much here. It was found in the deserts of Egypt. It's half eaten by ants or bugs or whatever you have in the desert. But what it contains is really remarkable. We think it's the only extant excerpt of Hadrian's autobiography. And we're looking at it now. It's a tiny, and you can see it's very fragile, a tiny piece of papyrus. But if a little more of this had been eaten up, we wouldn't have the entire story. I mean, this is the one document with the one bit of text. And there are quite a few of those in the exhibition. I think they're very powerful. This is what history is made of.
Torsten Opper, many thanks for talking to us. And Hadrian, Empire and Conflict is at the British Museum in central London until October the 26th. And you can look at some of the highlights on our audio slideshow at guardian.co.uk/art. And there's a longer version of that interview at guardian.co.uk/audio. The late Anita Roddick founded The Body Shop and turned it into a global brand, pioneering ethical cosmetics. And her daughter Sam has some of Anita's campaigning verve. She's an erotic entrepreneur, owner of the upmarket sex shop Coco de Mer. And she spoke to The Guardian's Hannah Poole.
I would probably describe it as an erotic boutique or a curiosity shop. I always consider that when the journey of walking into Coco de Mer literally opens people's curiosity that they might not have entertained before, and really the way that the curiosity arises, because it's wrapped in beauty, and beauty makes anything permissible. So whereas somebody might recoil in horror at the notion of doing a certain sexual act, when you present it with a twist that encompasses beauty and great quality, then suddenly it becomes a consideration.
What's the best-selling product?
This is very tricky. I think the thing is what I've learned about the sex market is that when you're providing something new, at first it doesn't sell, right? People come to it, they kind of circle it like a cat, sniffing, edging towards it, and then like a year later it'll be your bestseller, right? You're like, how can that product have no sales and then a year later it's sold? It's because basically people's imagination go from recoiling in horror to going, that's not so bad, like, how do you use that, to that's kind of interesting, to I'm going to buy it, right? There's a whole process which is actually an emotional process. And when people say, you know, you can't apply the same retail rules to sex, because actually it's emotional. You know, when you buy a pair of shoes, the parameter is pretty simple. It's, do they fit? Do I visually like them? When will I wear them? And what will I wear them with? Right? You know, it's quite basic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when you buy a sex tool, a lot of the times that people haven't even tried it, right? So you have to engage the imagination in probably one of the most private moments of your life, right? And it's quite a big ask for a consumer. That's why people in my shop come in and they spend an hour, right? They spend an hour looking around. It's very interesting.
Your shops can be quite intimidating.
Yeah, it can be quite intimidating because it basically is confronting each individual about what they desire. And there is nothing more vulnerable than revealing yourself and your sexual desires. We think we're a liberated society, but actually we're not.
I want to move on now and talk to you about Bondage for Freedom.
Oh, yeah.
What is it?
Well, Bondage for Freedom is the activist arm of Coco de Mer. It creates a platform where I can and talk and also contribute to all of the things that I'm politically interested in. And as I said, before I opened up Coco de Mer, I was a full-time activist. Coco de Mer was a response to what I felt was a necessity for us as human beings to have a dialogue about in terms of internally and also politically, right? And but I've always been a campaigner. And I've always wanted to turn Coco de Mer into like the sexiest Oxfam in history, essentially. And I work with a lot of different organisations, NGOs and charities and individuals. I work with Helen Bamber Foundation, Reprieve. I'm working next year, we're doing a Honey Bee, Save the Bee campaign. We're working with a number of different organisations.
Sam Roddick talking to Hannah Poole, and you can read Hannah's interview with Sam Roddick at guardian.co.uk/G2. The producers of Guardian Daily today were Peter Sale and Andy Duckworth. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.